ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening, this is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries, welcoming you to another one of our first of the month Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. Normally this is a live program, but this one is being pre-recorded due to my guest's schedule, so there'll be no phone calls tonight, but you can listen over radio station WWCR 4.840 MHz and 3.215 MHz, that's transmitters 3 and transmitter 1, or radio station WBCQ 7.490 MHz, and both of those stations do have an internet link. By the time you hear it, it will be available on our radio archives page. Go to kingidentity.com and go to the radio archives page and you can listen to it there. Much is going on behind the scenes, both nationally and internationally, that is unknown to those who only watch the establishment news media. To help bring to light what is actually taking place, my guest tonight is an author, historian, world traveler, scholar, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. I'd like to welcome back to the broadcast Mark Weber.
Thank you very much, Mike, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on with you again, and I'm glad we're here.
Well, thank you for being with us. It's a big subject tonight. Where would you like to start? The foreign policy, domestic politics, or what?
I think probably the most appropriate way to start is by noting that we're right in the middle of another election campaign cycle, 2020, and what it means. You mentioned that I'm a historian, and that's my training and my background, my study, my passion, you might say. And a historical view means a view of what's going on that's a little more detached or set above the day-to-day hustle and bustle of politics. And I try to look at events as they unfold, not so much in terms of who's on first or who's on second, but rather what they mean in terms of the underlying forces at work and what they portend for the future and what they and how they've developed out of processes and forces in the past. And the election cycle that we're undergoing right now, I think regardless of who wins, can already be said to show very clearly the process of dissolution and decline that's been true of American society now for some years. The 2016 election campaign was the first in all of American history in which polls showed that a majority of the voters said that they did not trust either of the candidates. And the millions of people voted for Donald Trump in 2016 because they fear or hate or loathe what Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party stood for. And millions of people voted for Hillary Clinton not because they thought she was trustworthy or good, but because they feared or detested or loathed what Donald Trump stood for and what he represented. And we're seeing a similar process develop during this campaign. It looks like, as we speak today, it may change that Joe Biden is the leading candidate of the Democratic Party, but he's not the leader or the front runner right now for the Democrats because millions of people think he would be a great president or because they trust him. To the contrary, they support for Joe Biden is overwhelmingly based on the desire by millions of Democrats or Americans to remove Donald Trump. But anyway, these are signs of a tremendous division and contentiousness and discord in American political life, similar only in American history to the period just before the Civil War. And it's really irreconcilable. I don't think anyone can see how this tremendous division that exists in America broadly speaking, between Trump and Republicans on the one, Trump supporters and Republicans on the one side, and Democrats or liberals on the other side, or minorities on the other side, how this can possibly be bridged. And all of that are some symptoms of a society that's really, I think, in terminal decline. There's no way to resolve this tremendous problem, because it's basically, fundamentally, a problem of identity. What does it mean to be an American? What does the United States really stand for? What are we all about? That's at the core of this tremendous division and debate in the United States about what kind of country we even are. And when a society is unable to come to a consensus, come to agreement about its basic identity, its basic purpose, it cannot, and its history, then it really cannot see the future very clearly. I've been very often denounced as a person who wants to so-called rewrite history. That's not true, but it's a charge that's often made. But in fact, we're going through a period of tremendous historical revisionism in our society, in which Americans or figures from the past who were once honored and held up in high regard, like Robert E. Lee or Christopher Columbus, are now vilified and demonized as terrible people. That shows a society has is changing some very fundamental ways it looks at itself, its past, its history, and therefore cannot come to any kind of agreement or understanding about its future. And that's why this campaign is going to, I think, just further exacerbate, further highlight these tremendous divisions and distrust in American society that we are already seeing and that will almost certainly be growing in the years ahead.
It's not only division between the two parties, but within the two parties, the establishment versus what they view as the outsider.
Yes.
Trump is hated by the Republican establishment, and not only is Sanders by the Democratic establishment, but even more so, Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard was completely buried just about by the establishment media and the establishment party members.
Right. Right. That's a very important point, that within both parties, there's tremendous conflict between the money and the interests of each party on the one hand and the base of support on the other. In the Democratic Party, here in California or nationally, the money, there's tremendous, well, in both parties, money from wealthy Jewish donors is decisive. It's certainly the largest. By far the largest donors to both the Democratic and Republican campaigns in 2016 and during the present are from very pro-Zionist, wealthy American Jews. Chaim Saban in the case of the Democrats and Sheldon Adelson in the case of Donald Trump and the Republicans. Hundreds of millions of dollars being thrown around.
Yeah, and also Soros.
And Soros. But the base of the Democratic Party is not like that. The base, the voting base of the Democratic Party, largely Hispanic, black, other minorities, they don't share the same passionate, abiding concern by the moneyed interests for Israel and its interests. They don't share the same concern for gay rights or some of the other issues that are so important on the leadership level. And within the Republican Party is a similar division between the establishment Republican Party and money on the one hand and the real authentic interests of the vast majority on the other. These are all such deep-rooted problems, it's hard to see how anyone can even imagine how these great divisions in American society can possibly be overcome. And that's the tragedy of America, I think, because these divisions have been building for a long time, and they're based on a kind of schizophrenia in American society about our national identity. On the one hand, millions of Americans are focused on individual rights, what's good for me and my family. On the other hand, there's a longing or a wish or an assumption that there's something more culturally, religiously, racially, ethnically, that binds together America as a country that Americans should have or ought to have in common. But that's impossible to uphold if the primary concern of people is individualistic. If people are focused just on what's good for me and my family and my neighborhood and my town, they're not going to be and cannot be really concerned about the cultural, religious, racial, ethnic transformations that are taking place across the country as a whole, with large implications for all of us in the years ahead.
Well, also the getting involved in foreign wars, especially in the Middle East. That's, I believe, one of the reasons that the Democrats buried Tulsi Gabbard, and certainly, at least in word, Trump is opposed to that, but the establishment constantly wanted to get us involved in places like Iran, Syria, and so on.
Well, across the board, whether people call themselves liberal or conservative, Republican or Democratic, they are unhappy with the terrible record of war that both parties have been pursuing for the last 40, 50 years around the world, but particularly in the Middle East. Within both the Democrat and Republican Party, people are widely aware that the Iraq War was a terrible catastrophe, not just in terms of the thousands of Americans who died, but the hundreds of billions of dollars that were squandered in that horrible thing. The war in Afghanistan, across the board, most Americans have long wanted us to get out of that endless war, which is now the longest lasting war in American history. But the establishment of both parties continues to grind on. And much to the disappointment, I think, of many Trump supporters, Trump has betrayed his own pledges and promises of getting out of what he calls these stupid wars, and has actually increased America's military spending and its role around the world in spite of the promises he made. And that's a strong sign of just how inept or corrupt or whatever our political system is, that even someone as supposedly anti-establishment as Donald Trump has turned his back on his own promises and pledges and the wishes of his own supporters, and has continued to maintain these wars overseas in Syria, Afghanistan, and even in Iraq. I mean, it's outrageous, really, and especially in the case of Iraq and Syria. Both Donald Trump and Barack Obama, one Democrat, one Republican, have had and have kept American troops in Syria in violation both of American law and of international law and of the will of the American people. That's an astonishing thing. In the case of Iraq, the Iraqi parliament, the Iraqi prime minister, the people of Iraq say want the American troops out of Iraq. Trump said he was going to get troops out of the Middle East, but now Trump says he's going to keep troops there in Iraq in spite of the wishes of the Iraqi people in parliament.
Well, of course, they're making millions of dollars in war profits. They spent just sending the missiles into Syria alone many millions of dollars. So there's that, and the heavy Jewish influence in the Trump administration, which makes us fight their wars and push their agenda politically in the world.
Well, there's a wide realization all around the world, not as great as in America as in other countries, that the prime factor in America's Middle East policy is what's good for Israel. This is a point made over and over by supporters of Israel in American political life who emphasize how important Israel's interests are in the Middle East. And in spite of the promises by Donald Trump that we would have an America First foreign policy, Donald Trump has emphasized and has said even explicitly that America's relationship with Israel is one that we should even be more in love with Israel than we already are, he says. It's impossible to have a pro-Israel policy like we've had in the Middle East for the last 30, 40 years, and at the same time support an America First foreign policy, which is what certainly Trump has promised, what his supporters want, and I think even what most Americans want.
Well, like I said, his administration is, including his own son-in-law and daughter, became a convert to Judaism, but he's pushing their agenda, and, you know, it's sad.
I mean, there's a lot of speculation about what's going on. A lot of it seems to be that his daughter and his son-in-law are looking to maintaining their role and their place in society in New York and among their friends and their wealthy class in New York after Trump is there, and they can't very well do that unless they push for a policy which Trump himself supports that's contrary to his own pledges, and one that's so one-sidedly pro-Israel against the interests not only of America, but contrary to the consensus all around the world about what policy in the Middle East ought to be.
Well, part of his broken promises is not draining the swamp, as he put it. The same people are in the deep state, let alone in his cabinet and various other positions.
Yes, very true. Well, when people say they want to drain the swamp, that's a promise that Trump made repeatedly. He made it even in his inaugural address. Presumably, when people say they want to drain the swamp in Washington, is that they want leaders who tell the truth, who are honest with them. But Trump has no record of being honest in that way. His whole life has been astonishingly underhanded or misleading. I'll give just one example. He makes a lot of fun of the fact that Elizabeth Warren claimed to be of Indian, American Indian ancestry in order to get into university years ago. But the Donald Trump family has kept up a myth that they've cultivated that their own family ancestry is Swedish. It's not. It's German. But during World War II, his father, who was a builder, thought it was more advantageous to pretend that the Trump family was of Swedish ancestry rather than German ancestry, because that was what was going to serve the family interests better during World War II, and I suppose especially in perhaps in New York City where he was active. And Trump family has kept up this myth, this deceit, in the years since. But Trump is more than that. He has misled and misrepresented for years many crucial things about his own life and about his administration. You might remember he was promised some years ago he was going to make public his tax records. He never did that. And he never did that almost certainly because he was very deceitful in how he presented his own assets and liabilities over the years, and probably exaggerated his assets for the purpose of trying to get loans from Deutsche Bank and other big banks, and probably downplayed his assets for income tax for tax purposes. We don't know the exact reason, but the point is that Trump has broken that pledge, along with many others, too. But he has a long record of these kinds of playing fast and loose with facts and so forth. And but my point is only that people cannot expect a leader of any kind to drain the swamp or have a more ethical government, given Trump's record, which was already obvious when he was running for president in 2016.
Well, his actions fall far short of what those of us who are generally called Christian patriots said. Yet what's sad is that he is actually probably better than any president we've had recently or in my lifetime, because such a low standard has been set by each of our presidents in recent years.
That's a very important point, I think, that expectations of Americans have really enormously fallen across the board. People have given up expecting leaders, I think, to be ethical or honest in the way that we used to expect of the American presidency or American political leaders, and they want merely someone who's going to who will be better at promoting their own interests, whatever they happen to be, or make them feel better or say things they want to hear. This was already true with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was very popular, especially among Republicans, but generally a popular president, because he made people feel good. But his actual policies were crassly in contradiction to the promises he made, numerous promises he made before he was president that he turned his back on. But he did it in such a charming way. He was called the great communicator for a good reason. He had been an actor. He was very good at giving speeches that made people feel good. But the actual policies he carried out were, in many cases, diametrically different than the ones he had promised to carry out before he became president. And we've come to expect that. We've come to expect, and that's one of the problems, is that American political life is increasingly a form of entertainment. People are voting less on what the actual outcome is going to be, especially over the long run, than whether this or that person says things that make them happy or feel good for the moment.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan, I'm from California also, but Ronald Reagan pushed through the gun control legislation out in California when he was governor, and then he was the one who pushed through the Martin Luther King holiday and said he'd sign it if the Congress would go along with it, and previously the Republicans always played loyal opposition and stopped that holiday from going through, but he was the one who got it through.
Well, Ronald Reagan had explicitly said he was opposed to Martin Luther King Day as a federal holiday, but yet he's the one that signed it into law. In fact, it's hard to believe that Ronald Reagan, or a man like him with his policy record, could even become a Republican leader. He signed into law the Simpson-Mazzoli Immigration Act, which gave amnesty to some 3 million illegal aliens in the United States. Today, that would just be unthinkable, but that's typical. There are many examples of that. As a candidate, he pledged to dismantle the Department of Education. He not only did that, he increased his budget. He was going to balance the budget. He, in fact, increased the national debt to standards that in his time were astronomical and unprecedented in times of peace. But anyway, that's just many examples. But my point is that what that has done is to lower Americans' expectation of political leadership that's going to be ethical or consistent or honest in their policies and in what they do.
Go back and name any recent president. Nixon recognized Red China instead of Taiwan. He took away the silver out of the coinage and so on. It's been that way ever since I was born.
We started talking a little about foreign policy. One of the tragedies, too, of the American system is that political life, everybody has opinions about taxes because everybody pays taxes. People have pretty definite opinions about education because everybody's gone to school or they have children in school. People have definite ideas about things like Social Security because they either are getting or will get or their parents get Social Security. They have very definite ideas. But Americans' views about foreign affairs are pretty fuzzy and hazy because we don't have, the vast majority of people don't have any personal relationship or personal stake in what is going on in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or these other countries, even though the cost to the American people is enormous. The Iraq war, the Syria war, the Afghanistan adventure costs, by some estimates, trillions of dollars, certainly many hundreds of billions of dollars. But because it's far away, people don't have strong opinions about it. In fact, a recent survey showed that most Americans can't find Iran, which has been a big target of American leaders, both Democrat and Republican in recent years, on a map. They don't even know where it is. But my point is that very little of the debate that takes place in any election campaign, including the one we're in now, revolves around foreign policy, even though foreign policy has tremendous consequences for the American people, because foreign policy is not something that people have experience with in the same way they do with taxes or education or highways or so on and so forth, Social Security, things like that. But that's a tragedy and that's a problem, because that's why we need and should have leaders who do have an understanding of these things. And unfortunately, though, the American political system elevates to prominence people on the basis of the pledges, the promises they make in domestic policy and tax policy and so forth. These people often are very ignorant or unaware of these larger foreign policy issues. That's especially true of Donald Trump. Very few people, I think, remember he had pledged, one of the strongest pledges he made as a candidate was he was going to pull American troops out of Afghanistan. About a year into his presidency, he went on national television and gave a talk and said to Americans that, well, he said, I've learned a lot being here in the Oval Office, that the Afghanistan situation is far more complicated than I had realized, and he had decided to keep American troops in Afghanistan. Well, that's an admission that he didn't know what he was talking about when he was a candidate for the presidency about the subject he was making pledges on. But that's part of the problem. And, of course, people don't really hold him to that because they don't really, most Americans don't really care or much understand about Afghanistan, even though this has big consequences for all of us. But the bigger question, really, in the Middle East and on these wars is why we even have troops in Iraq or Syria or Bahrain or on the Gulf or so forth in Saudi Arabia. Why is the United States committed to there? Other countries are not. China doesn't have troops. There are not millions of people in big crowds, death to China. They're shouting death to America because America has military bases and has fought these wars. Why do we do that? Well, the essential reason is because of America's commitment to Israel. And Israel's interest is to create maximum discord and chaos within the region because they understandably view the neighboring countries as actual or potential adversaries or enemies of Israel. And so they have an interest in breaking down Iraq or other countries that won't play ball with the United States or with Israel. But these wars are not wars that are in authentic American interests. These wars are wars carried out for Israeli interests, and not because American politicians really care about Israel, but because they care about being reelected. And they all realize that in American political life, Jewish financial support and involvement in the American political process is crucial if anyone's going to be very successful in American political life.
Yeah, they all take their turns speaking to AIPAC, but what they're doing in foreign policy, it's not only backing Israeli interests and costing a lot of money for the war, their war profit, but it's actually immoral. What we're doing, we're not in a fighting war, a hot war yet in Iran, but those sanctions are actually a form of warfare that are hurting the people of Iran. And even though we're America first, it's not right morally to do what we're doing to people in these other countries.
Of course. Of course. I mean, but moral considerations have also seemed to have just vanished completely from the radar screen of many Americans. It's illegal. It's wrong. It's immoral. America's support for Israel is supporting policies that, if carried out by any other country, the United States could find a pretext for going to war against that country. Israel is in violation of numerous Security Council resolutions, which the United States, as a signatory of the United Nations Charter, is pledged to uphold. One of the first things and most dramatic things that Donald Trump did as president was to cancel America's role with the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. But very few of his, even his own supporters, seem to care that that's entirely illegal, because the Iran nuclear deal wasn't merely an agreement between Israel, between Iran and the United States. It was an agreement made also with China, Britain, France, Germany, and Russia, and became a United Nations Security Council resolution, which the United States, according to the Charter of the UN, is pledged to uphold. The United States is in the crazy position of punishing countries and companies that do business with Iran in keeping with international law and with the 2015 agreement, and punishing companies and countries that are upholding and acting in accord with international law. Most of the world realizes that.
Yeah, it's hypocrisy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just astonishing. Well, I mean, in the case of Syria, basically ISIS, which the Islamic State apparatus in Syria has been defeated, and that was the pretext that the United States troops in Syria, and when Donald Trump said he was going to pledge to keep troops in Syria because we're going to control the oil. Well, this is unbelievable. Syria isn't owned by the United States. It's a foreign country. It's their oil. I mean, the United States would, of course, consider it outrageous if some other country were to start seizing oil wells here in this country. But anyway, this is just so blatantly illegal and wrong, so jaded.
Yeah, it's my understanding that those oil fields, the oil is actually going to the Israelis, and that's the reason we're protecting it, whereas other Mideastern oil isn't going to them.
Well, it's not that I think he wants the oil, even for the United States directly. He doesn't want it going to the Syrian government. In fact, it's not very well known. There's a U.S. Pledge made years ago that the United States guarantees to supply the oil needs of Israel, regardless of wars or any other conflict that may take place. That's a separate matter. But the point is, it's just so blatantly immoral and wrong for the United States to be keeping troops illegally in a foreign country to take control of the oil in another country where we're there already illegally. It's just incredible.
Well, as you pointed out, Iraq wants us to withdraw the troops, and the problem they're having right now with the agreement in Afghanistan is the puppet government that we as a nation put in. Otherwise, the talks perhaps may go well with the Taliban.
fundamentally, it shouldn't even be looked at, I think, in that way. The so-called talks, the United States shouldn't even be in the country. It's not our conflict. Whatever wars or internal problems and conflicts are going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, that's their business. That's for them to sort out. It's not the place of the United States to be the policeman about conflicts around the world, whether it's in Afghanistan or any other country. The logic of that view is the United States is supposed to be controlling basically everything around the world, whatever it can. That is a recipe, of course, obviously, for endless wars. There'll be no end to the wars in the world then, in that case. In a larger way, the United States is unable to do that. It doesn't have the power to do that anymore. The United States was at the height of its power around the world in the decades just after the Second World War. And the reason for that was that most of the rest of the world had been destroyed, or the bigger countries had been, in their industrial capacity, had been destroyed in the Second World War. That's no longer the case anymore. Now the rest of the world is built up. The United States, at the end of the Second World War, was so dominant financially, business, and so forth, that the big three auto companies of Detroit produced something like 90% of the world's automobiles. Today, China produces more automobiles every year than the United States and Japan combined. There's no cell phones made in America. They're made overseas. In China, in Japan, in Europe, there are large networks of high-speed railway that connects the cities of those areas. We don't have a single mile of high-speed railway here in this country anymore. The United States doesn't have the same clout or position in the world that it did in the 1950s or 60s or 70s. So that trying to uphold an imperial presence in the world that's implied by playing this policeman role is simply beyond the capacity of the United States. It's important to remember, even as it is now, America continues doing what it does by going into debt. We have this astronomical debt that increases every year. Basically, we're paying for our military bases around the world and the standard of living that we still have in this country by putting it on a credit card and giving the bill to our children and grandchildren. That's not sustainable over the long run. But nobody seems to care. Neither the Democratic nor Republican leaders are willing to really address this fundamental problem of America's indebtedness and its inability to pay its bills.
Well, also self-sufficiency. If we ever get in a war, our supply lines are going to be cut because so much is made in China and elsewhere.
America does have, fortunately, enormous resources natural resources that other countries don't have. We could be far more self-sufficient than we really are. But Americans have become very used to cheap products from around the world, but particularly from China, Vietnam, and so forth. We could be far more self-sufficient than we are financially and every other way if we had leadership that was able to explain all this to the American people and to motivate the American people. But we don't have a common identity. We don't have a common sense of purpose on which to get Americans to act in any coherent way. We don't have a common identity anymore in this country. The population of Americans changed over the last 60, 70 years. From a country in 1950 or 1960 that was 90% or 90-some percent European ancestry, it's now dropped to the point that very soon the majority of the population will be non-European ancestry. It's very difficult, impossible really, to maintain any kind of national unity and cohesion when racially, ethnically, and so forth, the country is so divided. It's one of the big problems of American life that our leaders lie to us. Bill Clinton proclaimed in an address to the nation that diversity is our greatest strength, he said. Well, that's just madness. And it's a sign of the bankruptcy of both parties that no leader of the Republican Party, no national leader, denounced Bill Clinton for making a statement that stupid. No country is stronger if it has 20 languages rather than one single language. Countries are stronger the more cohesive they are. And if the history of the 20th century teaches us anything, it's how fragile and how weak multi-ethnic, multiracial societies are, and how they will fall apart under pressure.
Well, the immigration policy used to reflect the founding fathers of this country, but it's my understanding that legal, let alone illegal, immigration is only 10 to 13% white anymore.
Certainly, it's contrary to the view of America and its cultural identity, its racial identity, its ethnical, religious identity that the founding fathers had. And of course, going along with that is the way in which our founding fathers, the founders of this country, the founders of America, are now routinely vilified and denounced, their reputations blackened by the mainstream media. A good example of that is a few months ago, the New York Times, with great fanfare, launched this so-called 1619 Project to basically define America in terms of its relationship to slavery, which is a gross distortion, I think, not only of reality, but certainly of the understanding of America that we've had for more than two centuries.
Well, they're distorting all of our traditions, even marriage, you know, between a man and a woman. Now they've got all this homosexual marriage and every kind of gender pushing. You can't even speak in a traditional manner in many of the public colleges.
It's an ironic thing that for millions of conservative Americans, the leadership and the outlook of the president of Russia is more in accord with their views than the religious and philosophical outlook of the political leaders of this country. That's a very sorry situation.
Well, a lot of it is the media. Yes, you'd like to talk about the people that, well, it's the Jewish ownership of the media, but it's left-wing, and not only in the news media, but in the movies, the public school texts, and so on.
Right. Well, of course, how our educational system operates, how our media influences, it's obvious that the mass media is more influential in shaping the views of people about basic questions, basic issues. Churches certainly are today. You know, several years ago, Joe Biden, when he was still vice president, gave a speech to a major Jewish organization in which he was explicit about this. He said that Jewish leaders have played a bigger role in shaping how Americans think and the social cultural trends of our country than any other single group. And he's right. That influence has been more decisive than the role of the major churches in American life, and certainly than the Anglo establishment that used to be very important in America's financial and business elite, business life. Yeah, the Jewish role in shaping how Americans think and look at things is a decisive one. And anyone who's contrary, who disagrees with that, they're denounced, they're marginalized, silenced. And we've seen this happen over and over. You know, it's astonishing. There's no better sign of this or symptom of this than the fact that when the leader of Israel speaks to the U.S. Congress, he gets this rapturous applause for him by politicians of both parties more than any American politician gives, American politicians give to any American leader. And Netanyahu gets more rapturous applause from the U.S. Congress than he does from his own parliament in Israel. And that's because this, what I call Jewish Zionist power, has this grip on America's cultural life, on the mass media, that is so intimidating and so influential that people are, including political leaders, are afraid to say anything against it, to oppose it. And that's a very, very fatally dangerous thing for any society.
Well, it's also being pushed by what I call the Judeo-Christian churches. It never used to be that way, where it was universally taught by the churches. They taught Christianity, and actually they called the Jews the Christ killers.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, we've seen over the last 30, 40, 50 years how all the mainstream churches, almost without exception, have capitulated on one issue after another in response to how the media presents things. The issue of so-called homosexual rights or gay rights, all the mainstream churches have abandoned the positions they've held for centuries and have realigned or have revised their views to be in accord with what the media tells them to do. And we've seen this over and over now.
Also, racially, there's no church, no mainstream church 100 years ago that would marry an interracial couple. Actually, back in the mid-1800s, that's how the reason they started the marriage license, to license miscegenation. But on all issues, they've compromised. And when this country was founded, most of the founders were looking for freedom. And now all the people think about is money, 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 which is a Jewish outlook on things.
Well, the largest Protestant denomination in the United States is the Southern Baptist Convention. And it's worth taking a look. The Southern Baptist Convention was founded just before the Civil War, when the Baptist Church in the United States broke into northern and southern branches over the issue of slavery. The Southern Baptists defended slavery, and the Northern Baptists were either neutral or opposed to slavery. And after the Civil War ended, the Southern Baptist Convention continued supporting not slavery, but segregation up until the 1950s. Now, of course, the Southern Baptist Convention has repudiated its own basis for existence, as it were, and its own heritage. And so it now exists on the racial issue, completely contrary to the outlook and the principles upon which it was established.
And that could be said about other churches, especially the Lutherans. They denounce Martin Luther now.
We're taught by our media to be ashamed of so much about European heritage and the legacy of European leaders, not only religious, but also in literature and political life over the last, over the centuries. We're supposed to be ashamed of that now. And Americans are supposed to be ashamed of the leaders of this country, whose views on a whole range of issues were diametrically different than the ones that are now considered acceptable and which prevail now in American life.
Well, when I went to school, the teachers themselves took pride in the nation's heritage, but now they not only don't teach true history, it's a complete distortion. I believe your organization questions some of the history. You teach a true revisionist type history. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, we try very hard to look at history objectively and without the distortion, which is now a part of the American prevailing American way of looking at all these things. It's just astonishing, really, how drastically things have changed in that way. But that's true both of world history, of the Second World War, American history. There's a huge disconnect, a huge difference between the prevailing narrative on the one hand, how people at the time saw it, or how actually events took place and unfolded at the time. Don't want to do self-promotion, but I urge people to take a look at our website, ihr.org. That's our main website, which has a tremendous amount of information about a whole lot of issues that I think discerning and curious visitors will find useful and informative and educational. There's a tremendous archive of articles and so forth on virtually every issue of real importance and that people can easily find. We also offer a wide range of books, leaflets, booklets, audio CDs, video DVDs. Yeah, that's easy, can be checked out as well. And there's a whole website devoted to ordering, ihrstore.com, but that can be found through our main website, ihr.org, as well. Really, the basic problem, really, in America is one of identity. And if America is a country for everyone, if it's a country of individuals, and individual freedom is the first and foremost consideration, then it will continue as it has for the last 30, 40, 50 years on the path that it is, and it will be increasingly a divided, contentious, discordant society. And I've been saying this for some years, but the 2016 election and the 2020 election will exacerbate that. I often bring up with people what they expect things to be like after Donald Trump. Whether he almost, well, it's very likely that he'll be reelected, but even if he's not, if he is reelected, after Donald Trump, it's hard to see where things are going after that. But one thing is clear. The demographic and cultural trends in America are still continuing as they have. Donald Trump is a man whose entire life had been devoted before he became a candidate for president to doing what's good for Donald Trump and his family. He doesn't have a coherent worldview. He has opinions, he has sentiments, he has feelings, some good, some not good. He's an impulsive man, but he has no overarching coherent worldview, and that's a tremendous weakness of the man. You know, just on religion alone, he seems almost oblivious to Christianity or even what Christianity means. He's nominally a Presbyterian. He was once asked in an interview about his religious views, and he was asked, "Do you ever ask God for forgiveness?" And Donald Trump said, "No, he's never asked God for forgiveness." And I thought, well, has he ever said the Lord's Prayer, which is pretty basic among most Christians, because every time someone says the Lord's Prayer, they ask God for forgiveness for our sins and our trespasses. But Donald Trump is almost childishly ignorant even about what Christianity, nominal faith, really means.
Well, a lot of his upbringing and the reason he's brought to prominence is because he played ball with the Jewish New York money interests. He had to play ball with those interests to promote himself.
Yeah, of course. He's from that same milieu, that same background, that same thing. I mean, he himself talked about how for years he supported Democrats, and he even contributed and gave money to the Hillary Clinton campaign earlier, 4 years before. Just before during the 2016 election campaign, I read several books written or supposedly written by Donald Trump. One of them, he's praising Barack Obama as shaping up as one of America's great presidents. I mean, Donald Trump is not a man with a coherent, self-consistent outlook or principles in his life. And that's part of the reason why, in spite of all his bluster, he's essentially a very weak president, not a strong president. He's chosen one cabinet member and numerous staff members who have turned out to be great disappointments by his own standards. And it's astonishing. I know some people will excuse it and say, well, he's got some bigger plan in mind. But it's pretty astonishing when he picks members of his cabinet for high-level positions that then after a period of time, he says they're no good, and he can't wait to get rid of them.
Well, they were establishment types in the first place, and everybody knew they were establishment types. Well, that knows what's going on in Washington. Even under Bannon, they used to call them the Democrats in the White House at that time.
Well, the Democratic Party, as you mentioned earlier, is in such disarray that whether they decide that Joe Biden is the candidate or Bernie Sanders, there's tremendous divisions within the Democratic Party. And given that, Donald Trump will almost certainly get reelected because he'll hold on to his own base of support, and he'll probably pick up support. The Democrats are united not by what they want, what they positively are in favor of, but by their loathing and opposition to Donald Trump. That's when people are motivated in a society by what they fear and detest rather than their ideals, that's a very, very dangerous thing for any society historically. I mean, the parallels between America today and other empires and societies in decline are so obvious. Frivolousness of society, an emphasis on the short term, corruption and deceit by leadership. I mean, these are so characteristic of American society. And they were also characteristic of other empires that have, in their decline, the Roman Empire, obviously, but others as well.
Well, what amazed me was the news media. I expected them to take a real left-wing stand during the election, but they kept it up. At least places like CNN would try to appear to be objective. They don't even try to appear anymore. It's just one long harangue against Trump, but not against him in general, only against him in those issues where he takes a stand that's good for the country, actually. In areas like the foreign involvements and so on, they completely ignore that.
CNN and the Democrats, of course, are eager to criticize Trump for things that they think they can get him, but they will not criticize him for violations of law or of crimes or misdemeanors if they're ones that Democrats themselves also carry out. Look, just alone, as I said, Donald Trump could be impeached for his policy in Syria or even Iraq, but certainly in Syria. There's no basis even on under American law for U.S. troops in Syria. It has no authorization by Congress. It's contrary to international law. But because the Democrats themselves are guilty of that kind of high-handedness, that kind of recklessness, they don't go after Trump on that basis. They go after him for silly and arcane things. This is typical. I mean, nobody's. But that's another feature of American life is people are not really held accountable for their actions. Nobody's been held accountable for the lies, deceit, the crimes of America's involvement in the Iraq War. Neither Hillary Clinton. I mean, Colin Powell later admitted how shameful it was that he lied to the world to try to justify the U.S. Invasion and occupation, bombing of Iraq in 2003, speaking to the United Nations. It was basically a huge snow job to the world and especially to the American people to justify that unjustifiable war. But nobody's held accountable. George W. Bush isn't held accountable. He still leads his life and has this quiet, comfortable life. That's typical of American society nowadays, that come good or bad, however screwed up things might be, nobody's ever held accountable or for their policies.
Yeah, and the policies of the Democrats in many areas are even worse. They want open borders, and they certainly get us in additional wars. Biden the other day said he'd appoint Beto O'Rourke to be head of his gun confiscation program is basically what it amounted to. So we'd lose more rights under the Democrats than we are under Trump. And neither one is up to a traditional standard that America used to have under the Founding Fathers.
But emphasizing rights is not really, I think, a main thing. I mean, very few Americans would prefer life in Haiti, which has less government interference in their lives than in Denmark. Denmark has strict gun control laws, high level of taxation, obligatory national health care plans. Haiti has no income tax. Essentially, gun control laws don't exist. The government stays out of your life. But which country would people rather live in? Well, even conservatives would prefer to live in Denmark rather than El Salvador or Haiti, which has less government interference in their lives. In other words, I think the dichotomy and the distinction between conservative and liberal or how big the government role in life is not a very important one. And I think you can find millions of conservatives who still say they care about the Constitution. I don't think they really care about the Constitution very much. Constitutions don't keep a country from being corrupt or ignorant or crime-ridden.
Mexico has almost an identical constitution to that of the U.S., but it's
right.
A different people. It's
a
lot of mestizos instead of the traditional European Western civilization of America.
Right. I mean, that's why the emphasis by many conservatives on the Constitution, I think, is inappropriate, because what's crucial to a society is not its Constitution, but the quality and character of its people. That's far more important than a Constitution. Britain doesn't even have a written Constitution. Constitutions are, I mean, a society is only as good as its people. And if the people are self-indulgent, short-sighted, foolish, criminal, no constitution in the world is going to change that, turn that around.
I believe that our constitutional government as founded is superior to monarchy, but I would rather live under a monarchy of white Western civilization people than I would in a place like Haiti with blacks or in Mexico with mestizo type Mexicans. There's a difference.
It's a remarkable thing that I try to talk with a lot of different people about how they view America today, how they view the future, how they think things will be in the next 5 or 10 or 20 years. And it's remarkable how intense, how probing people's questions and thoughts are now about America and its place in the world. Very different than when I was young. When I was growing up in the 50s or 60s, people just took for granted all sorts of things. Now, in America today, nothing is taken for granted, and there's a great deal of questioning about everything. And in that regard, that's why I think that the work we do is important, because we do try to look at more fundamental, crucial, underlying trends, forces, issues, than just the headlines or what's happening day by day or week by week or month by month. And people are asking these questions. Well, how important is the Constitution? What does really matter in a society? How important is the cultural or racial character of a society that I live in? People didn't ask those questions in the 1950s or 60s or 70s. There was a kind of naive optimism in American life in the 1960s that doesn't exist anymore. People have a tremendous anxiety about the future, especially for their children. And millennials, younger people, have a grave sense of kind of misgiving or anxiety about the future. So many young people are strapped with debt because they've spent years and lots of money to try to get degrees that are almost worthless on the job market now.
So well, everything else. Yeah, they get in debt. When I was a kid, all the people would get used cars, fix them up, and hot rods sometimes. Now they go in debt and buy a new car when they're just a kid. There wasn't that indebtedness, and there was, you know, we could play when we were little kids anywhere in the neighborhood or walk miles away and not be harmed. Now they're in danger of everything from a pedophile to gang warfare.
It's not just merely that the objective situation has changed. The mood has changed. In other words, there's just a far greater level of distrust and of apprehension and cynicism in American society. People are just less trusting. People don't hitchhike today. They're afraid. People are afraid if they're hitchhiking that somebody who picks them up will do something bad. And people who are driving are afraid that hitchhikers will do something bad, or at least will smell bad or be obnoxious. That was not the mood in the 60s and 70s. In 1969, 70, people were hitchhiking all over the place. There was a kind of a whole different attitude. And what has certainly increased in American life over the last 30 years is a much greater just distrust of other people. American motion pictures now, when they portray the future, overwhelmingly portray a very grim, dystopian, bleak world. And that is just one more sign of many others of the kind of pessimism that's now very, very widespread in our society. There was an important study done some years ago that got a great deal of attention to show that the more racially and ethnically diverse a society is, lower the level of trust of people, of others, even within the same racial group. There's just a far more hunkering down in American society. And again, that makes it very difficult to meet any challenge that's going to be that would arise. I mean, America today still cranks along reasonably well. We're out doing things and so forth. But heaven help the United States if it faces a real crisis as a country.
Well, America used to mean, when you said American, you thought of a white Christian man or woman, and generally speaking, and freedom-loving people. We're
right
about out of time here. Would you like to make any concluding remarks?
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me on again. It's always a pleasure being with you. I urge your listeners to check out our website, ihr.org. All the best to you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for being our guest. We'll have to have you back sometime in the future.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our costs plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA.
or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.